Well, your brief vacation from Leviticus is over. So if you have a Bible, if you don't have a Bible, we got some in a bookcase. I don't know if you've ever heard that before. But we want to turn to Leviticus. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus. Third book in the Bible. As I've told you guys before, we're going through this more on a survey style than an intensive verse by verse on this. And I've already explained to you why. I've had your attention for so long. I hate to lose it on all these things that a lot of times are very difficult for us as Americans to grasp. Thank you, my son. You may sit down. A prophet is not without honor, except in... Oh, well, anyway. Just kidding. I'm not a prophet. If we break down Leviticus, it breaks down this way. The first seven chapters, which we've covered, deal with the offerings that God prescribed for the Israelites. It illustrated for the Israelites man's need, his great need since the fall. He needed a sacrifice. He needed someone to take his place, because the soul that sins shall surely die. And so God set something in order, set something in place that would allow man to sacrifice another. A life was taken, but it was a life of an innocent substitute on man's behalf. Man had this need. So God provided the sacrifice, but the sacrifice was representative of man's need. Then chapters 8 through 10 dealt with the priesthood, the ordination of the priesthood, the sacrifices for the priesthood, and we looked at how that prefigured Jesus and what he would be for us as a perfect high priest. He wouldn't have to offer sacrifices like these high priests had to, because he's perfect. He isn't replaced every year because he passes away, but he is a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So we showed God's provision in that. It reveals God's provision. Then the rest of the book breaks down. Those are the chapters that we've covered so far. We've covered chapters 1 through 10. Chapters 11 through 22 deals with various dietary laws, issues of cleanness and uncleanness, and issues of behavioral codes. And we're going to be working our way through these chapters tonight. Chapters 23 to 25 deal with specific feasts and festivals that the Israelites would be observing. And then the last couple chapters are just closing remarks and reminders. So tonight we're going to cover chapters 11 through 14. And as I said, it's stuff that's fairly curious to us as 21st century Americans, trying to figure it out. You know, as we look at it, you know, what does it mean to us? How do we apply this to us? I have to tell you, reading through it and all, you have a tendency to want to almost read this like out of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, when they're getting the holy hand grenade. I don't know if you remember that. And they're reading through all of these things. And I kept, as I was reading it over, kept wanting to say, skip a bit, Brother Maynard. But either way, we're going to go over this as we look at, if you want to open to chapter 11 in Leviticus, we're going to look at this. I just want to, in chapter 11, I want to read the first four verses here. It kind of sets the stage for what this chapter deals with. It says, "Now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying to them, 'Speak to the children of Israel, saying, These are the animals which you may eat among all the animals that are on the earth. Among the animals, whatever divides the hoof, having cloven hoofs and chewing the cud, that you may eat. Nevertheless, these you shall not eat among those that chew the cud or those that have cloven hoofs. The camel, because it chews the cud but does not have cloven hooves, is unclean to you.'" And then it goes on. "The rock's hyrax, because it chews the cud," and on and on and on. "The hare, because it chews the cud," and you get the picture. So he goes through all of these things, and he makes a distinction here with the mammals. The first eight verses deal with mammals, air-breathing animals that are walking on the earth. And he makes the distinction between them in terms of how they chew their cud and the hoofs that they have, and what their hoofs are like. And that's how he divides between them. And he says, these are clean, you can eat these, those that have the hooves and chew the cud. Those that don't have the hooves, that have the toes or the paws, aren't to be eaten that way. And so God explains to him all through this these first eight verses. He explains to them what they have to consider to be ceremonially unclean. And I want to just mention this right off the bat. We're talking about clean and unclean, and we have a tendency at times to assign morality to that. And God was not necessarily assigning morality to these things. He wasn't picking on camels. You know, God doesn't sit up there saying, "Ooh, I hate camels." It wasn't anything like that. It was that he was just making a distinction. This is ceremonial issues here. So it's ceremonially unclean. He wasn't trying to make a moral statement about these animals. And we'll get to the reasons behind this as we go along in this. But he tells them that they can't eat it. Not only that, they can't even touch it if it dies the carcass, or they'll become unclean. And so there are certain ways and procedures that they have to follow in terms of taking care of this, because it will make them unclean. And of course, obviously, sometimes you're going to have an unclean animal that dies somewhere that, you know, maybe in the middle of a road or something. You can't just build a new road around it because you can't touch it. So there are provisions made for how they're going to touch it and how they're going to take care of it. So he deals with that. Then verses 9 through 12 deals with water animals, the fish and all. He says, these you may eat that are all of all the water. In verse 9, whatever in the water has fins and scales, whether in the seas or in the rivers, that you may eat. But in all the seas or in the rivers that do not have fins and scales, all that move in the water, any living thing which is in the water, they are an abomination unto you. They're an unclean thing. They're something to be kept away from. You don't want to get near them. So there's the division in terms of the fish. He says those that have scales and those that don't, those that have fins and don't. So catfish is right out. Eel is another thing. No sushi. So you're never going to find kosher catfish or anything like that. Then verses 13 through 19, he deals with birds. Verse 13, he says, "You shall regard as an abomination among the birds." In other words, an unclean thing, something they're to stay away from. They shall not be eaten. They're an abomination. The eagle, the vulture, the buzzard, the kite. He doesn't mean the thing that you fly down on the beach or whatever. He's talking about the bird. Because the fabric gets caught in your teeth if you eat kites. So he goes basically over this, and they're mostly, most of those in this list are scavenger birds. The eagle is a symbol of our country, and we love the eagle, but it's really actually a scavenger bird. And there is ample evidence to suggest that Benjamin Franklin didn't actually want the eagle he wanted the turkey. That's right. He felt like that was a far more noble bird and represented. Well, you think back about different people who've been in the White House. The turkey would have worked. But either way, so then verses 20 through 23 deals with insects. And insects of all things. But either way, he's going through. He wants them to understand what insects are okay and what insects aren't okay in terms of his law. This is the Levitical code. This is his law he's setting up. And he's determining what things are things that the Israelites are going to have contact with or be able to consume, and what things they're not. And as I said, we'll get to the whys, because immediately you should be sitting there thinking, why? You know, what is the big deal? As far as insects are concerned, he goes in verse 21, yet these you may eat of every flying insect that creeps on all fours, those which have jointed legs above their feet and which leap on the earth. And so those are the insects that are okay. You can eat those. You remember John the Baptist, he was out eating locusts, and locusts fit that criteria. So he was munching down on those, and that was okay with God in terms of the Levitical law. He was okay. Obviously, what should pop into your mind is, you know, creeps on all fours. What is up with that? Isn't the definition of an insect something that has more than four legs? You can immediately think, okay, is God confused? Is Moses confused? Who's confused here? Well, I don't think anybody's confused. I think the idea behind this is he's talking about mimicking an action. He's talking about moving after a certain pattern. If it moves like the animals of the earth moves, like an animal would move on all fours, or, you know, in that kind of a bent position, that's what he's talking about, that the insect moves in that way. I think it's dealing with with movement much more than it is talking about specific numerical value to legs. Anyway, verses 24 through 40 provides some ideas about how they're going to dispose of unclean animals. Verse 28, look what it says there. Whoever carries any such carcass, he's talking about the unclean animals, shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. It's unclean to you. So again, we see this is ceremonial stuff. There's no sacrifice involved in this. This is not a moral issue. This is a ceremonial issue of clean and unclean. So if a guy has got to move a dead camel out of the way or whatever, then for the rest of that day until the evening, he's considered unclean. That means he's not going to touch anything. People aren't going to touch him. You know, he's not going to go run around, you know, shaking hands with everybody or whatever. He's got to consider himself off limits at that point. So the provision is made there for how they're going to deal with that. And they're to be disposed of immediately. And one that is going to dispose of these animals is going to have to wash ceremonially. And this is really interesting because there are some hygiene aspects to this. You're talking about a pre-medical society. You're talking about a culture that's living out here in the desert. And there are a lot of things about God's law that are fascinating in that sense, just on the pure hygienic level. That back in the 1300s, when the Black Plague, the bubonic plague, was sweeping through Europe, the reason that it was moving so rapidly and destroying so many people was because of the rats. The thing about the Jewish communities is their method of handling and disposing of rats was so precise, and they were so careful about washing and doing the ceremonial washings, etc., that the bubonic plague was actually not coming to the Jewish communities as such. They were spared by and large because of that. Unfortunately, they weren't spared the persecution that erupted from that, because people looked around and said, hey, the Jews aren't being affected by this. Obviously, they've unleashed this on us. And so there was terrible anti-Semitic uprisings during that time. But you can even see how God's law was actually something that was preserving them just because they were following these prescriptions, and just on a purely medical level, they were being careful about their hygiene and what they were doing, following God's commands on this. So it's really interesting in that sense. Verses 33 through 35. I was going to read that, I guess. He talks about how you're supposed to deal with, get rid of something. Any earthen vessel into which any of them falls, any of these unclean animals, in other words, like if a rat falls, you shall break it, and whatever is in it shall be unclean. In such a vessel, any edible food upon which water falls becomes unclean. In other words, you know, if water drips on the vessel that has had the rat that fell in it, if the water is in it, the water's unclean, the vessel's unclean, and any drink that may be drunk from it becomes unclean. And everything on which a part of any of such carcass falls shall be unclean, whether it's in the oven or the cooking stove. It shall be broken down, for they're unclean, and they shall be unclean to you. So you can see how that would have worked. Whereas some people wouldn't have thought anything about it. You know, the 10-second rule or 2-second rule? I guess it varies from house to house. But either way, you know, the idea is, it's okay. You know, we can still eat dinner with it. But for the pious Jew, he wasn't about to do that. He was going to follow God's ceremonial laws, and so the whole thing was unclean. You get rid of it. You dispose of it, which had, you know, great benefit in that sense. It preserved them from a lot of things. So anyway, verses 41 through 43, he identifies some creepy crawlers here. He goes through all the different things. Every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, verse 41, shall be an abomination. It shall not be eaten. Whatever crawls, verse 42, whatever crawls on its belly, whatever goes on all fours, or whatever has many feet among all creeping things that creep on the earth, these you shall not eat, for they're an abomination. And he goes on explaining, you know, how much you're not supposed to like them. And so he's talking basically about snakes or centipedes. These are unclean to them. So you're not going to find, you know, kosher snakes or kosher centipedes. And of course, as I was saying, you know, you're questioning through all of this. I mean, if you read, take the time. It's a good thing to do. It's God's word. So take the time, read through it sometime. Use that little voice from Monty Python. It helps. But and the question that pops in your mind is why? You know, why, God? So much of this up to this point we've gotten some really deep meaning from. You know, we look at the sacrifices and the imagery that's involved in that, and you recognize man's need and God's provision, and his plan is written all over it. And you're kind of building up, and here's this priesthood who comes on the scene, and they're flashing white robes and the gold and the sacrifices and the burnt offerings, and there's a certain level of drama. And then you get to centipedes and and why you shouldn't eat them. And it's a little bit of a letdown. You're looking at it thinking, why? What is the big deal about this? Why did God have them do that? Why did God do this? And so basically, verses 44 through 47 will break this down for us. I want to read it. God is kind of explaining it to them there. This is why, you know, he says, I don't want you to touch these things. You'll be unclean. You'll be defiled by them. Verse 44, for I am the Lord your God. You shall therefore consecrate yourselves, and you shall be holy, for I'm holy. Neither shall you defile yourselves with any creeping thing that creeps on the earth. For I'm the Lord who brings you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. You shall therefore be holy, for I'm holy. Holy means separate, set apart to him, distinct, different. For I am the Lord who bring, verse 46, this is the law of the animals and of the birds and every living creature that moves in the waters and of every creature that creeps upon the earth, to distinguish between the unclean and the clean, between the animal that may be eaten and the animal that may not be eaten. Well, if we were to break this down, we were to look at this, he kind of gives us a breakdown here. In verse 44, he explains right off the bat why he does this. A, he's God. He says, but here's why I want you to do this, because I'm God. I mean, frankly, we couldn't really stop right there. He's God. He's kind of got us there. I mean, he can do whatever he wants to do. He can say whatever he wants. I mean, however he wanted to set up his law, he could say, you have to wear happy clown hats from now until I get back. And he's God. We just have to do it. We just have to follow that. There's no really arguing with that. But there is something more that he gives us. He gives us more than just that. He could have stopped there. I do that with my kids all the time. They say, why? Why? I did it when they were little. Or it was easier then because I didn't have to fight as much. But you know, they'd say, why? Why do I have to do this? And I'd say, because I'm dad, you know, and that was it. And, well, it was supposed to be it. But anyway, that's kind of the thing. You know, this is what I want you to do. These are the ones I want you to eat. These are the ones I don't want you to eat because I'm God. And that's what I'm going to do. But he does give us more. In verse 44, he continues with that. And he says there's a certain level of wanting to restrain them from defilement. And that's the whole idea about an abomination, something that defiles, something that would make them unclean. And see, I think there's a certain level of connotation that does speak about hygiene in this. I mean, just on a very practical, basic level, there were some real hygiene issues, and some of these animals, especially you look at pork, but a lot of different things like that. You know, in that day, at that time, the pigs were carrying trichinosis. If it wasn't cooked properly, you could have had some serious problems there. As we stated in the 1300s, you had the issues of bubonic plague, you know, disease and different things like that, which could have been spread by these various animals or problems like that. But I don't even think it was just purely hygienic, what he was getting across in that. I believe that there was a spirituality to this. And I think that God was using this to illustrate the concept between there being a right and a wrong, a clean and an unclean. All of this, all of these things, what God was doing was he was revealing to the Israelites, here's all of this creation. You're living in this great big world. And this great big world that you live in, I'm making a distinction in here. I'm showing you that some of this is going to be okay as far as I'm concerned, and some of it's not. Now, I would almost go as far as to say we'd almost be wrong in saying, well, yeah, here's the reason why he did it. You know, these animals are not that good, and these animals are much better, et cetera, et cetera. I read one guy's commentary explaining, well, here's the reason he did it, because it has to do with what's normal. You know, cows are normal, but the other things aren't normal because they got toes or whatever. Well, I mean, who's going to decide that? You know, you could build a great racist kind of doctrine out of something like that. So I don't think it's that at all. I think that God just went through and pulled things of their kind and put them together and said, now, this is to illustrate to you that there's a thing that I will approve of and there's a thing that I don't approve of. Remember, this is a holy God trying to reintroduce himself to a fallen humanity. They don't know who God is. They don't know who they are. They don't even understand this sinful world that they're living in. And so God is trying to illustrate it. See this great big world? I'm showing you that I'll take some of this and say this is okay, but all of this over here is not okay. And the stuff that is unclean outweighs by a vast majority that which is clean to the Israelite. And I believe what he's trying to communicate to the Israelites and then to humanity as we look at it in retrospect is that this world that we live in, that we've always known, that we've grown up in, that we've always assumed was normal and the normal way it's supposed to be, God is saying, this is not the way I intended it to be. This is not right. There's a right and there's a wrong. There's a clean and there's an unclean. And until you recognize that, until you realize that I transcend this, I'm above this, my way is the right way. My way is the clean way. I'm trying to reintroduce you to me, to who I am, to my righteousness, my holiness, how I live in the perfection in which I dwell. You've lived in this fallen world. You haven't understood where you were. You've looked at everything and assumed, well, everything's here for me and I can take it all in. And God's saying, no, no, no. So much of it is here to destroy you. There's only this, and it's mine. And that's what I believe is communicated in this. We try to bog down and try to assign all these different meanings to the different animals. I think we missed the point on that. God could have made any distinction he wanted. He could have reversed it all, and I think it would still have gotten the same point across. Whatever God identifies as being his is right. Whatever God doesn't identify as being his is what we stay away from, what we don't consume and take in, what we don't want to be defiled with. And so there's a lesson in that. There's a concept in that that I think he's trying to get across. This world, I believe he is getting across to us. This world is that which defiles. And we'd take that today and look at it and realize, okay, the world is representative of this culture that we've grown up in. It's always just been the normal way of life as far as we're concerned. It's always been the normal thought patterns as far as we're concerned. What I love, I should love. And what I don't like, I shouldn't like. And that's the way it should be. God's getting this message across. No, no, this world defiles. I do not defile. I'm the one who cleanses. I'm the one who makes righteous. And so it causes us to pause maybe a little bit when we consider the world that we live in and consider the things that we take in, consider the alliances we make and the loyalties we develop. What are we aligning ourselves with? What are we taking in? Will it defile? Will it draw us closer to God? You know, I can't sit here and define that for you. I've made that clear. I won't do that. I'm not going to define for you, unless the Word of God defines it very clearly. I'm not going to define for you how God is going to lead you through the choices that you make through this life. But it doesn't negate the fact that as His followers, as His children, we have to be cautious and careful about what it is we take in and what of this world we bring to our own self and wrap ourselves around. It may be different for you than it is for me, but we got to be listening to the Holy Spirit and following His directives on this. I feel like I was shaking my finger there. I'm not shaking my finger. I promise you I'm not. From my heart, I promise you I'm not shaking my finger. I'm just saying stuff with my hands, you know. What would ever happen if I broke my arms? We'd never hear another message again. I shouldn't say that because I don't want my arms broken and I can just hear the gears turning. Hey! but anyway, he says in verse 45 that he's the God who brought them out of Egypt. He's the God who redeems. So he has a claim on us to draw us into his purposes. This is what he's telling the Israelites. Listen, I redeemed you. I rescued you out of Egypt. Just as he rescued us out of sin, he's got the claim. He can call the shots as far as that goes. When we say that we're a believer, you know, we got people going to be baptized this Sunday. That's what this is all about. We're saying we're letting go of our own claim to our own life. We're placing ourselves in his account. He has his claim on us, and that's what's important. And that's what he's saying here. I redeemed you. I can tell you what to do. And it's not some angry despot who's saying this. This is a benevolent God. This is a God who refers to them as his children. This is a loving father who's just saying, I'm dad. I know what's best. I'm the one who brought you out of this. I'm the one who rescued you. You listen to me and I'll bring you through it is the message that comes across in that. And so we go to chapter 12. Chapter 12 is a lot shorter and it deals with the ritual that a woman would go through after childbirth. Let me just read through it real quick in chapter 12. It says, and the Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to the children of Israel saying, if a woman has conceived and born a male child, then she shall be unclean 7 days, as in the days of her customary impurity, she shall be unclean. And on the eighth day, The flesh of his foreskin shall be circumcised. She shall then continue in the blood of her purification 33 days. She shall not touch any hallowed thing nor come into the sanctuary until the days of her purification are fulfilled. But if she bears a female child, then she'll be unclean 2 weeks, as in her customary impurity. She shall continue in the blood of her purification 66 days. And when the days of her purification are fulfilled, whether for a son or a daughter, she shall bring to the priest a lamb of the first year as a burnt offering, and a young pigeon or a turtle dove as a sin offering to the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Then she'll offer it before the Lord and make atonement for her, and she shall be clean from the flow of her blood. This is the law for her who has borne a male or a female. And if she's not able to bring a lamb, then she may bring two turtle doves or two young pigeons, one as a burnt offering and the other as a sin offering. So the priest shall make atonement for her and she'll be clean. All right. You know, we look at that, and again, we're trying to read this through the lens of American culture, and boy, it is a difficult fit. But he goes through and he explains that if it's a male child, she's going to be unclean for 7 days, followed by an additional 33 days. If she bears a female, she has a daughter, then it's going to be twice as long. And this has to do with postnatal discharges. And this was a ceremony, you see. We got to understand what was being communicated in this. A ceremony that was pointing back towards original sin. That mankind is conceived and born in sin. That's what the Bible tells us. We can't escape that. I know our culture and the general consensus is, oh, man is innately good. You know, man is internally, every man is good inherently, and if he just knows to do right, he'll do it. But the Bible tells us a different truth altogether. The Bible confronts us with something that's completely the opposite, that in sin I was conceived, and that we're born in sin speaking lies from birth. And the idea behind it is man's depravity. We were born in sin. We were, ever since mankind fell, this whole concept of sin is passed through every generation. We're sinners by birth, by nature. We were sinners. Now Jesus changes that for us, and that's the whole message of the gospel. That's the message of salvation. But where it began here, and that's what this is pointing to. There's the sense of this, of the sense of the sin being carried in the blood and the passing of the blood. And there's a sense that God is trying to get across with that, and how it's passed down through humanity. But in actuality, even beyond that, and I know that it seems kind of misogynist on the surface. You look at that and what's up with that? But really, if you think about it, and you think about it in light of the cultural surroundings of that time, I mean, there's a great deal of mercy involved in this. As you look at this, the woman for this period of time, you know, 7 days plus another 33 days, if it's a male, twice as long as that, if it's a female, for that period of time, she's considered unclean. Okay, we'll take the concept of clean and unclean. And remember, we're talking about ceremonially. We're not talking about morally or anything like that. We're talking about just in terms of what ceremony calls for. You're talking about a woman now who no longer can do the chores. She can't touch any of the stuff around the place because it makes it unclean. She can't go visiting. She can't bring in water. She can't do anything like that. She can't even go to church. She can only do one thing, and that is hang out with that baby and bond with him or her, with her for twice as long, because there's a special connection between mothers and daughters that passes through that. There's an incredible amount of mercy involved in this. You look at the culture surrounding it, there's no such thing as that. I've read about Native American tribes, you know, the women, you know, were out in the woods having babies and back to work, you know, in a day or so. I mean, the whole concept was that this is just a function that they do, and then they're to, you know, get back into their place in society. But here, right off the bat, God's demonstrating this mercy and his care and concern, I believe, anyway. You can read it and see what you see in it, but I believe this is God demonstrating his care and concern for not only the child, but also for the mother involved in this, and allowing for that bonding to be able to take place. It's really actually a good thing. And if we keep it in mind and realize that when we talk about clean and unclean, the only identification of morality would be in the keeping of God's law or the not keeping of God's law. That's where morality comes in. But in terms of his identification of clean and unclean, it's not a moral issue. It's a ceremonial issue. So anyway, I think there's great tenderness in this. So after the time of purification, she's supposed to make an offering for the child. It's either going to be a lamb, or if it's poor people, if the person is too poor, then they're supposed to take two turtle doves and offer that in place. And I can't pass this up. I just got to jump over here to Luke. You don't have to if you don't want to, but Luke chapter 2. You know, there's all these guys that talk about how Jesus was rich and God is only interested in how much money we're going to have and we can't actually be effective. I've heard guys on the TV say this, that, you know, you can't bless people, you can't bless this world unless you've got money, unless you've got stuff, and that's why you're supposed to pray this prayer. God, give me my stuff so that I can be a blessing, and I'm useless unless I've got finances or money. And so as I look here, though, at Luke chapter 2, and I look at verses 22 to 24, it says, "Now when the days of her purification according to the law of Moses were completed," we're talking about Mary, the mother of Jesus, "they brought him to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord, as it's written in the law, the Lord, every male who opens the womb shall be called holy to the Lord." Verse 24, "and to offer a sacrifice according to what it was said in the law of the Lord." What is it she offered? "A pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons." No mention of the lamb, because their family couldn't afford a lamb, obviously. Jesus was not born in the wealth. And when you think in terms of being able to be a blessing, and only being able to be a blessing if I've got a certain amount of money to be a blessing with, or anything like that, I can't think of any family that has blessed the world any more than Joseph's family, who brought Jesus, the Messiah, into this world. You know, so the concept behind it, they had to bring the cheap, you know, the budget sacrifice because they couldn't afford the other. And yet God's blessing, of course, was on it to such a degree that 2,000 years later, we're sitting under the blessing of that. We're the recipients of it. Well, anyway, on into chapter 13, it details how to deal with leprosy. And leprosy, as it's described in the Bible, was dealing with any kind of skin abnormality. And let me just read verses 1 through 4. "And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, when a man has on the skin of his body a swelling, a scab, or a bright spot, and it becomes on the skin of his body like a leprous sore, then he shall be brought to Aaron, the priest, or one of his sons, the priest, and the priest shall examine the sore on the skin of the body. And if the hair on the sore has turned white and the sore appears to be deeper than the skin of his body, it's a leprous sore, then the priest shall examine him and pronounce him unclean," or pronounce him defiled. So this goes into how a person is supposed to be examined all the way through verse 8, you know, how they're supposed to look it all over. And then in verses 9 through 44, there's a great deal of detail given as to how they're supposed to diagnose this, which is interesting to me, because God didn't want this just to be guesswork. He wanted this to be the result of careful examination. He wanted them to look them over, and, you know, you don't just say, "Oops, you got a boo-boo there, that you're leprous, you're unclean." He wants them to look them over very carefully. And you realize that leprosy proper, of course, was highly contagious, a real problem. It was considered, you know, like AIDS is in our culture, and it had that same stigma associated with it. And there was a great deal of seriousness that they had to take concerning this, and they had to make sure that it was contained because it was so highly contagious. But, you know, leprosy also paints such a picture of sin. And the way sin acts in life, and how it has worked throughout the world, the contagiousness of it and its effect. It may seem like nothing at first, maybe just a little sore, maybe just a little something that we wanted to get into or we fell into or whatever, but left unchecked, left unexamined, it spreads and becomes a problem until a person's defiled. It ruins a person. And that's why we see that the high priest was to examine, and the image in that is that we're to allow the great high priest, Jesus, to examine our hearts, coming before him, you know, not in a sense of self-condemnation or anything like that, but just allowing him to have free reign, to check over our hearts, and being willing and humble enough to place all of our life's goals and decisions and choices before him. Let him examine it. And make a determination on that. It's the only way that we're going to be finding ourselves following in his will. If we leave sin unchecked in our lives, we allow it to just spread. Testimonies are ruined. Witnesses are ruined. Ministries. How many ministries have we seen ruined because sin was left unchecked. They didn't allow the great high priest to examine and make a determination whether that should be followed, a path should be followed or not. And so in verses 45 to 46, he says, "Now the leper on whom the sore is, his clothes shall be torn and his head bare, and he shall cover his mustache and cry, 'Unclean, unclean,' and he shall be unclean. All the days he has the sore, he shall be unclean." He's unclean. "And he shall dwell alone. His dwelling shall be outside the camp." And so here's the state that he... This is the result of leprosy. He's supposed to live in a continual state of mourning. His clothes are torn. His head is bare. He's unclean. And he's in total isolation. No one can touch him. No one can get near him. And this, again, is a picture of sin and its effect on humanity, how it separates us from God and it leads us away from God. And we're isolated and alone, and that aching sense that we're alone in this world wants to creep back in when we allow for that in our own lives, even after we've been forgiven by Christ and even after we're in fellowship with him. When we allow that, the enemy has that opportunity to give us that sense that we're cut off and separated from him. And so we see, though, in this, the magnitude of what a diagnosis of leprosy would be. Later on in the Jewish history, they took this even further, and they determined by how many feet a leper had to stay away from people, and no one was allowed to touch him or talk to him. And as a matter of fact, he was automatically, when he was diagnosed, it changed in the oral law. When a person was diagnosed with leprosy, he was also then cursed, because this was seen to be a manifestation of God's curse upon him for his own sin. And so it's his own fault that he's a leper, basically, is the idea, and he's got to stay away from everyone. And what's beautiful then is you think about Jesus. You know, we went over that in Matthew chapter 8. Remember how Jesus dealt with lepers. When the leper came after the Sermon on the Mount, came up to Jesus, and of course you can imagine everybody was scattering in that, and Jesus walked right up to him, and the guy was saying, "Have mercy on me. If you will, I'll be healed." And Jesus, it said, remember, he touched him first. First thing Jesus did was touch him. Not worried about unclean, not getting out his tape measure to see if he was too close to him or anything like that. Jesus reached out, touched him, gave him that comforting, healing touch, and then said, "I will be clean." There's how Jesus handles lepers. He cleanses them. He doesn't isolate. He doesn't push them away. And that's how Jesus handles us even when it comes to sin. Oh, the enemy has had a field day in the American church. Well, in probably every church, but I know in my own experience where we fall into sin, we have a problem, and we automatically make these assessments. Well, I've got to stay X amount of distance away from God, and I can't start praying, and I got to get my act straightened out. I got to get cleaned up before I can do anything or get back in touch with God. And Jesus is there as the continual reminder, no, 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 I come and I find you. I touch you, I hold you, and I will make you clean. That's his heart towards us. He comes running after us, even though we run from him so often. His heart is to scoop us up and make us clean. He touches us while we're unclean. So let's see, verses 47 to 59, which is the rest of the chapter, goes over what to do with clothing that may have leprosy in it. Nothing worse than leprous clothing. I found that in my kids' room before. Leprosy, remember, has a broad definition, so it could also mean mold or fungus or things like that. Anything that might pass on a contagious disease, and someone might think, well, I can still wear this, you know, it kind of looks nice. So God's saying, you know, no, don't. it's leprous. And then chapter 14, boy, it's just so late. You know what? I'm going to quit there. I really wanted to go over chapter 14 with some detail, and I just don't have time. And so we'll quit there for tonight, and we'll come back. We'll get back into the whole leper issue. It's great in Leviticus when we get together next time. But there's something beautiful in chapter 14, something that just leaps off of the pages, you know, right here in the midst of God dealing with this stuff that just seems so, you know, sores and runny. All of a sudden, God puts this picture in the middle of it of Christ and his sacrifice and what he provides for us. And it blows my mind every time I look at it. And so I got to be able to take the time to do that. And I'm almost doing it right now, but I'm not going to. And so we'll quit there and we'll pick up next time. So, Father, we just thank you for your word. And, Lord, I just pray that as we go over these things, I pray, Lord, that it's not that it's not a hassle for us, Lord. I pray that our hearts and our minds are opened up and we recognize the beauty of what you've planned all along. Lord, I'm so grateful that you did picture this plan in the Old Covenant, that you showed us Jesus and you showed us where we were going and you revealed yourself through it. But I'm also equally grateful for Jesus, Lord. And I thank you that you've made a way so that it's not a matter of my working or my ability to make things right, but it's your grace and the sacrifice of Jesus Christ on my behalf that makes me whole and makes me right with you. And so we thank you for these things, Lord. And as we consume your word and we take it in, Lord, I pray that it has great effect in our own lives and hearts. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Just real quick, I got one more thing that I did.